Busby, Stills, and Nash, and Young, and Himmelfarb, and Weiss, and Riskind. Oh, my God, there's too many names in a band. There should not be more than three names in a band. It gets confusing, and there's something pretentious about it. But we were hearing the lovely song Woodstock. It's a song by Joni Mitchell, but, of course, sung here by CSNYMRFPQ. Not from Woodstock, although they were there, as well as the other artists that were in that Saturday Segway thing there. Dave will tell you about that when he gets back. But I am not Dave, of course. I am Rabbi Saul Solomon, the spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And Dave has asked me to conduct the interview that is going to be happening right now on Dave's Gone By, on this very radio program. It is an interview with an author, a designer, a facilitator, what else? All sorts of wonderful things. His name is Elliot Tiber. Oh, I hear him in the background. He's chewing at the bit. He's Jewish, so he can't stay silent for 4 seconds while I'm doing his introduction. Good morning. Good morning. Morning, Elliot Tiber. How are you doing? Shalom.
Good morning, Shalom. It's Shabbos, and I guess you don't want the Chassidim to listen to your show, huh?
Nobody listens to my show. What can I tell you? It's not my show anyway. It's Dave's show. He's a very nice man. He lets me come on here sometimes to do my rabbinical reflections. I'm going to be talking about the Pope later. This is very exciting. I'll probably get death threats, but I get that from my family. So, Mr. Tiber, or should I say, Mr. Eliyahu Teichberg...
I paid $12 to change it to Tiber when I was 18.
Why did you do this?
Because I was going to be an artist, and you couldn't get jobs in New York in the ad agencies of a Jewish name, and I hated my family and everything they represented, and so I paid money to change it.
Do you regret that, or do you ever think of changing your name back, or are you forever Elliot Tiber?
I'm forever Elliot Tiber, except in the last 3 years, since there's 7 million blogs about me, all of them give the name Eliyahu Teichberg. So there are Teichbergs under rocks that I haven't spoken to in 50 years that have been writing me and calling me, and I just get rid of them fast.
Well, they probably just want money. I know I do. What do you have in your wallet? Because I'm broke. I could use it. Well, anyway, I'm asking.
Shabbos, I don't carry money on Shabbos in my wallet.
Now, wait a minute. You mentioned before we even started talking that you're Jewish, but you're an atheistic kind of a Jew. So, yeah, are you Jew? Where are you on the Jewishness curve?
I'm an atheist of all religions, all of them. To me, the way Bill Maher so beautifully put it in his film Religiosity, it's just the pollution of the world and humanity, and because of religion, we're in the big trouble we are in now.
But then again, what do you believe in? Can you believe in nothing? Can you believe that it's all here just because it's here?
Oh, I believe in a lot of things. I believe in movies and in books and in theater and music. And
who invented celluloid? Who invented the phonograph record? Who created sound?
That was Sidney Yalowitz from Bensonhurst. He invented it.
I knew it. I knew it was Yalowitz. I wasn't sure. Wikipedia has had differing explanations on that. Thank you. Thank you. I wanted backup on this. Anywho, we're talking to Elliot Tiber, the author of Taking Woodstock, upon which the Ang Lee film was based, and also his brand new book called Palm Trees on the Hudson from Square One Publishers. Now, what is the difference between these two books that you have written?
Well, they're in reverse order. Palm Trees on the Hudson, the true story of the mob, the Jewish mob, Judy Garland, and interior decorating, is the prequel to Taking Woodstock. The Taking Woodstock book and movie was such a phenomenal success, the publishers wanted the prequel to it. So it's everything from my days in Bensonhurst and my parents' store and the yeshiva of Flatbush and high school and college and my career days leading up to a week before Woodstock.
Oh, my God. You mentioned the yeshiva of Flatbush. Did you know that the host of this actual program, Dave, almost went there? He went to a place called Bialik School in Brooklyn, New York. Have you heard of this?
No.
Oh, it doesn't.
Like the Bialystok bagels?
No, no, Chaim Nachman Bialik. You know the poet, the guy? He wrote
okay, yeah.
They named a school after him.
Almost doesn't count. You had to be molested in Yeshiva Flatbush. The other yeshivas, the rabbis there, didn't know how to molest.
Now, hold on. You're not lying about this. You were of molested. You were molested at Yeshiva of Flatbush. How?
Well, I was a rebel. I was forced. My mother wanted me to be a rabbi, so I was forced to go to yeshiva 6 days a week. And on Sundays, they would ask, who didn't go to shul yesterday? And the rabbi would have the ruler out to hit you. In those days, that's what they did. They hit you with a ruler. And I was always proudly raising my hand. I said, no, I didn't go. And I didn't know yet there is no God. I didn't go because I wanted to go play ball or go to the movies or paint my paintings. And so I kept getting hit with the ruler in the back room, behind the classroom, on the rabbi's lap, and I didn't understand what was going on. It was lap dancing, because he was playing with himself and then with me, and I was scared out of my mind.
Did he take your pants down, or was he smacking your tushy with the pants?
Didn't take the pants down.
So he wasn't. He was playing with you, but where was his hand going, for God's sakes?
Well, he was jacking off. Am I allowed to say that on your radio show?
If you weren't, it's too late now, but okay, yes you are. He was, or as we say in Hebrew, he was Yaakoving off. That's how we like to put it here.
Then I was 13 in graduation time, and apparently I was first in my class, I don't know how, and I had to make a speech on the stage in Hebrew and in English to all of the 500 parents, children, rabbis, whatever, and I went up to the Aron HaKodesh, the Holy Ark, for those who don't know what that is, where the Torah is kept, which you're not allowed to touch, not tray for hands like mine. I was having pizza in those days, which was tray for hands. I didn't yet have pork. You know? And now I'm a vegetarian, so I don't have any of that stuff. But so I went up to Holy Ark, and I opened it up, and there was a hush in the auditorium and shock. And I was delighted, and then I turned around, and instead of the speech that was approved, I said, there is no God.
Oy.
Well, 3 or 4 of the teachers and the rabbi come running up to the stage to hit me and yank me off, and I said, Rabbi Weiss, what are you so upset about? Why don't you tell them about what happens in the back room every day, every Sunday, that there was no words lap dancing then, but that you were messing around with me, fooling around with me. I don't know what words I used, because we didn't know in those days. And so the rabbi ran outside, and my parents yanked me out, and that was my exit from the rabbinical world.
My God, sounds like Shabbos in my house. Hoy, Beitik. But now,
you said, oh my God, that means you have God in your house.
He's there. Yeah, he's in a cupboard. If I need a little bit of reassurance, I open the cupboard. I think, oh, there's God. And then I close the cupboard and I go on with my day. I'm a rabbi. I kind of need a little bit of God in my life. That's just
me. I'll give you advice, Rabbi.
What's the advice?
Have some halava instead. It works better.
Well, what do you think halava is? Oh, I have a piece of halava. Oh, I thought you meant to say halavai. Oh, yeah.
No, halavai.
Halavai is good. Nestle's chocolate better. But anywho, as crazy as this Rabbi Weiss was, who was tickling his pickle while you were doing the Hebrew thing there, your parents were even crazier. This is in your book, Palm Trees on the Hudson. Maybe even worse in some ways than you see George Costanza's parents on Seinfeld, because both of them were yellers. You had one yeller and one milk toast, one henpeck. Is this true?
Yeah, well, henpeck is a polite way of saying my dad absolutely never stood up for anything. He just did what Mama said. And she would stir him up and say, Yanko, his name was Jack, look what Ellie did today and some terrible deeds I did. And I would run up to my bedroom and lock the door, and because he would run upstairs, take off his belt, and he would whip me. And that was the beginning of why I liked S&M so much. Years later, I got involved with S&M and leather and whips and all of that, but I didn't know it at the time. But he would whip me. And then Mama would come up after the whipping with a food tray. Darling, now you're a good boy. So that was the message. It was clear when you get whipped, you're good, okay? And I didn't know it then. In my black bedroom, I painted. They sold paints and housewares in this store. So I took home gallons of black paint. I painted the whole room black. I was 11, and I liked black already. The whole room black. was also because my father had a little roofing company, and one of his helpers was a young black stud guy. I don't remember his name, about 20, and to me, an old man. And he would take me down in the basement. We had a coal bin, and he would do stuff with me, which I didn't know what it was about until years later in analysis. So I started to like black also, black walls and black guys. It was a wonderful upbringing.
Now hold on. But this black person, when you were 11, at that point, the rabbi, obviously, that was, you didn't like, you didn't want. Were you at the point when you were 11 that the black person doing things to you was already a pleasant thing? Or was it still too young and obviously
it was... It was four when he started in the basement. I used to play in the coal bin with the coal, you know, because I didn't have any friends. Nobody liked me. And I didn't fit in. They wanted to play ball, and I wanted to draw and paint. So I was ostracized. So I played in the coal bin, and when it was about four and on, and he used to come down to shovel the coal and stuff like that and was messing around with me, which I didn't remember anything till I was around 22 or something in analysis, or 18, whatever, and it came out.
Well, if he was in the coal, are you sure he wasn't a white guy just covered with coal soot? Never know. You may have touched him and it would have come off. You don't know that. No,
I guess he must be dead by now. Unfortunately, I would go find him.
And what would you tell him? What would you say to that man?
Let's do more. It was very good.
But the problem... No, it's not the problem. But, you know, when homophobic people, of which I am slightly, but only slightly, people who don't understand gay life and homosexuality would say, you fit this bad stereotype of why people turn gay instead of being born gay. You had horrible parents. Your mother was awful. Your father was beating you. You were molested here and there. I mean...
No, I didn't say I turned gay. No, I believe genetically that it's in there. They have proof, the scientists, about in the brain there's such as whatever it is. In gay people, there's a difference from straight people. I think you're born gay. You don't know about it. You may not understand it. You can blame your parents. I don't blame my parents that I was gay. I was born that way. They just helped it along, that's all.
So, and you have never thought of that perhaps you're bisexual. Have you ever stripped a woman? Just curious.
I went out with girls, of course. That's what you did. And I dated girls in high school. I was in the theater group. I was in the high school band. And I dated this girl, Roberta, who played a cello. And I was big and tall. And she needed someone to carry the cello for her. So when I was about 18 and we were in college already, and I tried to kiss her on her front porch. And her mother saw and started to scream and carry on. And in those days, at 18, kissing was just about acceptable. So I got punished for doing that.
At 18?
I was 16, I guess. And so her brother, she had a twin brother. She was gorgeous, and so was he. And he was friendly with me and tried to calm me down about it all, and he made a pass at me. That was the first time that... Not in a coal bin and not in a dark movies. I used to go to the Times Square movies when I was 12 on. Of course, that's what they did in those movies. And I didn't know what it was that they were doing, but it was pleasurable to me, you know, sexual release, which I didn't even know what it was.
So for this girlfriend, you played the cello, and for her brother, you played the skin flute? Is that how it worked?
Yes.
Wow. Huh.
So that was, happening then. But in the in those years, everything was, it's not like today, 12-year-olds know all about sex and abortion and everything else in between. In those days, you didn't use any foul language. You didn't, or you got your soap literally in your mouth. And you certainly didn't do sex, or you didn't admit to it. I'm sure everybody was doing it. And so I was doing it on the side, but I never acknowledged it to myself even.
And, well, at what point then... did you, quote-unquote, come out?
Let's see. In college, in my second year in the drama group, there was people in the theater group there was my neighbor.
It's always the theater kids. Always the theater kids. Yes, continue, please.
Well, Johnny Cuba, he was Italian. And handsome, and we used to ride to and from school together in his car. I didn't have one in his car, And then he made a pass at me, and we started to kiss. First time I ever kissed a guy. And it was all very exciting, and we became lovers for about a year until I found out that there were others. He took me to a gay bar, which I didn't even know it existed. There were only two in the village at the time, and we went in, and I couldn't believe all these guys were homosexuals. It was just amazing to me. And so that's when I came out.
Now this, at least you were away from your parents. You got the heck out. You were smart enough to get yourself. It's very funny in the book that you wrote. There is this apartment that sounds like absolute holy hell, unholy hell, when you first get there with the schmutz. You're peeling off one layer of schmutz on the floor, and there's another layer of schmutz underneath. But you would...
I was about 16, and I had enough, and I was starting college early because my mother put me in school 2 years earlier. She didn't have time for me, so I was younger than other students. And I started to leave home. I packed my paper suitcase. I went to the front door, and my father, I said, I'm leaving permanently, and my father gave me $10 or $20. They didn't have much money. And mother stood there and saying, when you'll fail, don't come back because I'm renting out your room, and I'm changing the locks, and goodbye and good riddance. That was my mother's parting words.
Now, she's like this throughout, excuse me, but she's out this, I'm telling people, throughout the whole book. In the book, you say the one time she was proud of you, this is actually funny, but it is so Jewish. She wasn't proud of you when you started getting decorating jobs. She wasn't proud of you when you got your own paychecks, when you had your own place, when you did good things. When was she proud of you?
When I got a job teaching as a professor, teaching art at Hunter College. Then it was my son, the professor. She was in heaven.
That's funny. I just find that so amusing. But it's funny because, damn it, it's true.
Well, she said, if you can't be a doctor or a lawyer, at least a teacher. So I said, Mama, these are the three choices you got. I said, interior decorator, hairdresser, or ballet dancer at the Metropolitan Opera Ballet. And she fetched her heart like she always did. I'm having an attack. She never did, but she said she did.
Let me ask you something. These parents, and you really get the full sense of how, with all due respect, how awful they are in Elliot Tiber's book, Palm Trees on the Hudson, from Square One Books. But did they live long enough that you could go back to them and said, my God, how you screwed me up. My God, you should rot in hell, both of you.
Mother did. She was 97 at the Hebrew Home for the Aged in Riverdale when I had the confrontation. My dad died in 1970, a year after Woodstock, and I had moved out after Woodstock. I made so much money. I moved out to the coast to work in movies, I had hoped, but I had to come back. And I went to the hospital. He was in intensive care. And the doctor said, no use talking to him. He's out of it, and he's expiring. But I talked anyway.
Yes.
And held his hand, and which I never did. We never hugged or anything, ever. And he never said, I loved you, and I never could say it to him, of course. The word love never came up in our house. I loved my doggie, but that was about it. And I loved chocolate ice cream. So I hugged his hand, and then I was talking to him, and then he said to me, he was like sort of lucid. He said to me, it's okay, I know about you and your friends. My friend Andre, I had a lover at the time. Your friend Andre, and it's all right. You have a good life. You have a good life. And then I said, Papa, how could you live with that woman for 40 years, that terrible mother? So he said, I love her.
Hey, some things are inexplicable.
Just knocked me out of the box, you know.
And in some ways, probably you loved her, even though she didn't deserve it.
I tried to get her love all those years, and then I made a whole life for myself. I moved to Europe, I became a writer, and star of my own TV series, and made movies, a whole new life. Never came up. It came up again with my book on Woodstock, because I had to talk about my parents and my mother and all of that. And so for 3 years now, I'm being interviewed, and like with this one, I'm talking about her. I tell my kid sister, who I'm friends with, and so she says, "Lass up, leave Mama alone already." She had a different experience with my mother. She disagrees with everything I say. And I don't know what planet she was living on, because she was the same environment, but that's what it is. And So unfortunately, she's back with me. But my mother was 97 in the Hebrew home, and for 12 years, nobody was helping her, and I got her in that place, and I paid the bills because I was making a lot of money.
You should have put her on an ice floe. You should have shipped her to Alaska and just watched the glacier slowly.
I didn't know about Libya. I should have sent her to Libya.
There you go. With her personality, anyway, she would be running Libya right now, let me tell you. But speaking of having different thoughts and different takes on the truth of what happened, there are different, explanations and people somewhat refuting your part to an extent in Woodstock. But let's get to that. That was your first book. Taking Woodstock. You were still...
No, that was my third book. That was the first one that made it the way it did. I had a bestseller in France and in Belgium before that.
Well, Belgium doesn't count. They're neutral.
Belgium
doesn't count. But okay, so your third book, but the book that clicked, the book that sold multitudes of copies and had the movie done by Ang Lee and all that. So, I mean, you say you did what to help Woodstock get off the ground and be a concert in 1969. What did you do?
Well, I'm the gay man. I emphasize that, gay man who saved Woodstock, because the reason I wrote the book is because for 40 years, not one of the Woodstock people or anybody else would even discuss that it was a gay man who saved Woodstock. Let alone somebody else saved Woodstock besides the original producers. They had lost their permits in a nearby town up in the Catskills. I forgot the name of that town, a terrible town, Fishkill.
There's a name for you, Fishkill.
Yeah, no, another kill. Anyway, Wallkill. So they were thrown out because the town in the front page of the paper showed one of their redneck farmers with a shotgun pointed at the Woodstock birdie on the poster, and it said, "We don't want our town overridden with 10,000 hippies, drug addicts, homosexuals, and dirty lesbians. Why raping our cows on Main Street?" Well, I'm a vegetarian. I didn't get that part. But why lesbians have to be dirty, I don't know. I'm friends with many lesbians, and 99% are not dirty. Anyway.
I wish I had seen enough of them to know myself, but anywho, continue. Please continue.
So they were thrown out, and here I was. I was in with my parents. We had a bungalow calling in a little hotel we built and were trying to survive with. This is when the Catskills lost everything in 58 or 59, when we started it all, and the hotels were all going bust because the airplane was invented and people could go to Paris or to Puerto Rico for cheaper than a hotel in the mountains. I didn't know any of that. I wasn't a businessman. So there we are, and my interest was, besides my parents sold their business in Brooklyn and were going broke, and there I was helping on weekends, dumping in my salary from the city into that stupid place called the Almonico. I made that name up because I didn't want it to be Sonia Teichberg's bread and butter or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so I became president of the Chamber of Commerce because, to quote Ang Lee when he discussed this with me, you need commerce to have a chamber. But that didn't matter. I was president of the Chamber of Commerce, and my Underwood typewriter, there were no computers then, I typed up a permit for a music festival every year for 10 years, from 59 to 69. And I had on my lawn, I played records in the sun, Judy Garland, always Judy Garland, and Barbara Streisand and Neil Diamond. And we had plays in the barn. I got actors from the village to come up there, a theater company called Earthlight Theater Company. And we were trying to do Shakespeare in the Catskills. Nobody came, so we did As You Like It. We changed the name to Sex You All Come. Nobody came. And I performed. I wrote monologues, and I performed my comedy. The only one who came, who bought a ticket to the music festivals and my theater, was my milkman, Max Yazga.
Oh!
Yeah, he paid his dollar, and he brought eggs and cheese and for the actors, running out of food. We were eating the grass for salads there, and not the weeds, grass. And so there we were, and here, sitting there and brainstorming with the actors, what do we do to have a season? This was in July already, or June, end of June. What do we do? And so there was on the headlines in the papers, they have no permit for the music festival anymore, and they're thrown out. And I thought, hey, I have a permit for a festival. I've had to look through all of the boxes to find the paper. And I called him, and I said, who are you? And I said, never mind who I am. I have 15 acres of ground near you, and I have a festival permit, a legal permit for a music festival. So they said, where are you? White Lake is not on the map. And I said, well, we have maps from White Lake that says White Lake. And I told them, and they said, well, not by highway, by helicopter. How do we find you? And they said, you have a hotel, so take some clean white sheets, which we didn't have. We didn't have a washing machine. And make a cross on the lawn, and we'll be there in 10 minutes. My mother, the actors, and all hysterical. I made the big cross. Mother came out and she said, what is this, the Ku Klux Klan? Are you Miss Sugar? What are you doing with my beautiful linens? And the actors, I didn't tell them to, all got undressed, and 33 of them, and the monkey and a goat, the mascots, and painted on their bodies peace, love, and music. Mother was just wild, didn't know what to do, ready to call the sheriff. And then the helicopter arrived. Out got Mac Lang, the producer, and his lawyer, and his assistant, Tish, with a little Yorkie. I've had Yorkie since. I didn't know what it was, a little cute Yorkie. And where's the permit? So I show him the permit. The lawyer looks at it. He says, well, it looks legit. I said, what do you mean it's kosher? The only stamp I had was from Max Yazka's butcher department that said, kosher stamp. What else can I stamp it with? We couldn't afford a Chamber of Commerce stamp. So I said, it's kosher. Let's see the land. I took them to the back. Our 15 acres were mostly under water. We couldn't afford real plumbing, so we had a lot of cesspools, and so it was a swamp. And so their hearts went down, and we can't do it here. They're ready to leave. They said, we need dry grass. I said, wait a minute. My milkman has hundreds of acres of nothing but dry grass, a bunch of cows. He can move the cows away. So we drove up to Max, and the rumors on then in the papers, everything, there were 10,000 people, tickets sold. And Max said, look, for $50 a day, you could have the place for the 3 days, providing you clean up afterwards.
Okay.
Nobody knew what that meant, of course.
Right.
And by time we finished meeting, 2 hours later in a restaurant on the local radio, the waitress's husband was the DJ, said that here's Elliot Tiber of Neomonaco with Max Yazger and Michael Lang, and they're going to bring Woodstock to Bethel, the town of Bethel. And 25,000 tickets have been sold, and Neuve, and blah, blah, all of this stuff. So Max's price went up to 1,000 a day, and then as the weeks went by and the numbers climbed, his price went up to 50,000 a day. After that, I didn't hear from him anymore, so I don't know what he got. And so for 6 weeks, we were getting a festival ready, but we were surrounded by local Nazis. You heard the word Nazi.
I know that word very well, unfortunately.
Well, I'm not supposed to say the word Nazi. Thugs is the approved way, my publicist tells me, but that's what they were. They were the children of German immigrants, so came after the war and settled there. Lots of those families settled there, and they put swastikas on my hotel wall, and the words faggot, get out. Mother and father didn't know where the word faggot, but the word, the Nazi swastika, they knew, and we whitewashed it over. So that was the wonderful environment. So these Nazis demanded money, your payoff, or else they were going to get a judge to cancel the permit and no more festival. And it was the festival was supposed to be Friday, August 15th, I guess it was, and that was Tuesday, and they said they wanted $100,000, which could have been like $1 million in today's money. I told Mike Lang, what are we going to do with the festival? And I told Mother, all that money, they rented our rooms instead of $8 a day that we couldn't get the normal price. They were paying $175 a day, and they took for the whole season cash in advance, and they took cash out of a shopping bag, and Mother grabbed the cash, and last we saw of it, she hid it in mattresses under the oven, wherever she hid it. And I said, Mama, don't spend a dime, as if she would. Don't spend a dime. We'll have to give the money back. It's not going to be a festival. So Mike Lang says, listen, and the radio, this is the power of radio. The networks all rented rooms by me because there was no place else indoors to rent. So they said, go in room 104. It's NBC Network. We've set up a coast-to-coast broadcast and you live, and you tell them what's going on. and to come on out to the festival. Otherwise, you know, we'll lose it all. And I was nervous. I was never on radio before and did public speaking. So I went on, I introduced myself, and I told them what was going on. And I said, and if you want to have 3 days of peace, love, and music, and all of these big singers that were coming, please don't wait till Friday. Come out now, because the Nazis, the local Nazis, are trying to close us down. And I was stunned because everybody was smoking weed, and so was I. That's how I was introduced to weed up there, and a lot of pills of all kind and acid. Exactly. So I was really stoned, and I added in a little bit. I said, oh, if you don't have tickets, it's not a problem. Come on out, because it's all free. Music should be free. The festival's free.
Ay, ay, ay.
So the producers did their ay, ay, ays, and it was too late. And that was Tuesday, and that was the end of it. I was in a room with a microphone. Wednesday at 3 a.m., everything is quiet up there and no lights. It's a tiny town. There are no street lights or anything. Suddenly, we hear noises, and we thought it's the locals coming with to beat us up or whatever. We took our baseball bats, my father and I, and ran outside, and there was the two-lane road, Route 17B, was two lanes, was now five lanes of white headlights coming in our direction, as far as the eye could see, and kids on school buses, all the stuff you now people are familiar with painted peace signs and flowers and guitars, singing the Joni Mitchell song, which was the first song about Woodstock that came out, and everybody's singing, and we put on all the lights. My father took a flashlight and assuring people I took a magic mark. Well, he didn't have a magic mark as then. I made a sign. I was always painting signs because I was an artist, and Woodstock, because there was no sign that even said Woodstock. And that's for us. The festival began that Wednesday morning. And the town board, the town fathers, this Friday morning at the beginning, official beginning festival, went out on the highway with about six or seven of their families and their children with a little paper sign saying the festival's closed. Nobody knew who they were or cared. They walked right over them. And the festival, that's how I saved the Woodstock Festival.
Oh, Mike. Why do you think, then, that there are... if you read accounts or Google them, that it not everybody quite agrees that you had that much to do with it. Is it? Do you think it's because you're gay, you're Jewish, or just that, you know?
Because I'm gay. And when I came back from living in Belgium in around 80 or something, nobody knew where I was, and Mike Lang called me, found out you're back. They put me on TV, Life magazine, telling my whole story, Charlie Rose. The word gay was never mentioned, was taken out everywhere. They're all so homophobic. In all that time, with such intimate dealings with the people at Woodstock, the kids that came to see it, their gay sex was the same as any other sex. But not one of the people, the principals, ever discussed that I was gay.
Well, wait a minute. Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you're, and by the way, let me mention everybody, it is 11:03 in the morning on March 5th, 2011, and you are listening to the Dave's Gone By radio program. I am Rabbi Saul Solomon, taking the mic here to talk to the wonderful Elliot Tiber, the author of Palm Trees on the Hudson, and of course, Taking Woodstock. We're talking about Woodstock and how he was involved in that, and also his homosexuality, which you are bringing up in that context, but I'm wondering why it was germane. I mean, did they bring up the fact that you were Jewish?
Who bring up?
In other words, you're saying, and all the time, and all the words, and all the ink, and all the media about the Woodstock and you.
They never even discussed being Jewish. The fact is that the people who organized the original Woodstock, the two money guys, Joel and Roseman and Mike Lang and Artie Kornfeld, they're all Jewish. Nobody mentioned it was a Jewish group.
Right. But my question then is, why do you get so angry and head up that in all your dealings and all the stuff about you and that they talk about, they don't mention that you happen to be... Why would that be germane that you are a homosexual?
To them, it wasn't. To me, it was, because gay people are always looked down on as misfits and druggies and sex perverts and can't do anything valuable or viable in this whole world, from Oscar Wilde to Tennessee Williams, Truman Capote. All are ignored as being gay. It comes up because it's now a historical fact and it's safe enough distance. And with me, they just ignored it. And I was furious. So for 40 years, it's ignored. When I met Ang Lee... And I'll tell you if we have time how I met him. And I pitched the book to him as a movie and all of that, I said, listen, this is an important condition. You cannot change my character and make me sexless. I'm gay. And it has to be clear, it's a gay man who did all of this. So Angry said, I wouldn't have it any other way. He did Brokeback Mountain.
Right.
About the two gay cowboys. And so I felt comfortable with that, to telling him that. Who am I to tell a big Hollywood mogul, director, what to do? But I did.
Well, it's your book. If he wants to do your book, he's got to do it your way. You do have that power.
And he followed through. He absolutely did the film. It's very clear I'm gay in the whole movie, and all of that is there. And
do you like the movie? Do you like taking Woodstock?
A beautiful movie. He did a brilliant job with it. It's touching. It's funny. It's sad. My parents, he got two British actors of all people, and they taught them for 5 weeks how to have a New York Jewish accent. Goodman is Jewish, but he played Fiddler, so he knew that. But Melda Staunton is Catholic, and so they taught her that. And I cried when they set up a private screening for me before it went to the Cannes Festival to show me the movie. They wouldn't let me in the editing. They never do. And I cried because it was looking at my mother and father up on the screen, except they cleaned up my mother a bit. But all of the craziness of her and all of her disturbances and sicknesses were all out there to see. And they were funny. And when you tell it as a story, it's funny. It was very painful for me when it happened.
Of course.
But in the movie and the book, I make it funny because I deal with humor. Humor as a way to survive. I always have. I'm a humorist. I do monologues. I speak cross-country in college, universities, everywhere. And humor is how I get my information across.
Well, I guess I relate to that occasionally. being a rabbi and trying to get my misanthropic points across as well. But let me ask Elliot Tiber, the author of Palm Trees on the Hudson and Taking Woodstock. The other major event, well, you've had lots of major events in your life, but the other one, and since we are talking in the homosexual gay kind of circles, was that you were physically at Stonewall. Is this correct?
Oh, yes. During this six-week period we were getting ready, I went in when I had a chance for a couple of hours. Once a week I'd go into the city to a gay bar because there was no gay activity in the beginning at Woodstock, and so I was alone and lonesome. So I went in, and at 11 at night to Stonewall, was one of two bars in the village, and it was mafia owned, and they didn't allow gays. Homosexuals could not get licenses for liquor, so that's how it worked. And then also the police were on the take, and they came in, and it was nothing was hidden. They came in, the bartender would hand them a bag of money, and that would be it. But the police always hung around outside the bar, and quite often, if you left alone, they'd beat you up, take your money, and beat you up for kicks. I always make sure I left with a friend because it wasn't safe. And this one night, I don't know what was in the air.
Well, wasn't it the night that you know who died? Wasn't it?
No, Judy Garland died, I think, right after or right before it.
Oh, I thought it was the same night.
About that period. No, it wasn't the same night. It was a few nights difference. Okay, I don't remember the exact night. And we didn't talk about Judy Garland anyway. But so that night in the bar, we were talking amongst each other, and we decided to, I got an iron bar and put it across the doors. We're not going to let the cops in. We're not going to let them hassle us. Someone hollered out, gay power. Well, that phrase didn't exist, nor did gay pride exist. Someone hollered, gay power, and we felt empowered. There were only a couple of dozen of us in the bar, and we wouldn't let the cops in. And then I thought to myself, I said to one of the guys, listen, we're big. Why don't we go out there, three or four of us, and overturn that cop car and demand that Mayor Lindsay come, and let's get this thing out in the open. This harassing is enough. And so we went out, we overturned the police car, and screaming for the mayor, and eventually the mayor did come, as well as a crowd of maybe 1,000 people out front, Allen Ginsberg, who lived on the block included, and the poet. And that was the Stonewall Revolution. And it was the beginning. And a few weeks, sometime later, a couple of months maybe, we got started with Gay Pride, the first ever Pride Parade, which attracted 2 million people to Fifth Avenue, most of them straight. That was where the word Pride came in. We were proud of ourselves. So that was my participation. I became an activist then, and I've been an activist all of these years since. I am now on the board of GayAmericanHeroes.com, which you can look up, and it's about fighting hate crimes, gay and lesbian hate crimes, but all hate crimes included, especially young people who are murdered and nobody does anything about it because they're gay or perceived to be gay. And so I'm still very active with that. And oh, I mentioned Judy Garland. When I was 10, Mama took me to the movies Tuesday nights because they gave free dishes.
And, Bakelite, right? Or was it Bakelite?
Regular, real dishes. No, real dishes. There wasn't Bakelite then. You say you're younger than me, obviously.
Oh, okay.
No, real china dishes with flowers on it. Ugly. And that one night there was playing Wizard of Oz, which I had never seen, of course. It was out, I think, in 39. This was around 45, let's say. And 43, I don't know. And there was Judy Garland, and I see this magic movie, black and white and in color, and that there's a place you could have home with if there's love in there. And boy, did that resonate with me. I didn't know that home meant a place people love you. And so it really affected me. And I started in collecting Judy Garland records over the years and her pictures. And I saw her concerts. I saw her at Carnegie Hall and Radio City Music Hall. As I got older and there were the concerts, I bought seats front row center and brought flowers for her. And I handed it to her one performance, an opening night, I think it was. And she handed one back to me with a kiss as she sat on the apron of the stage. And I've always had Judy Garland with me in my mind's eye and my heart all these years, as many, many people do, and many gay people do. And if you Google Judy Garland stuff, you'll see why the gay community has taken Judy Garland as their heroine, so to speak.
I always assumed it was because she suffered. I figured, oh, she was always in torment.
Yes, it was that she suffered and she was in pain, but she also had, of course, gay husbands, as Liza Minnelli does or did. And but she suffered, and besides, what a major talent. And she was so small, everybody wanted to hug her and make things nice for her, so to speak. And then when I was a decorator, I was decorating for the Jewish Mob, a famous nightclub in New York. I didn't know they were the Mob. I found out suddenly one night. They hired me to decorate the SS Peter Stuyvesant ferry on the Hudson River for the 50th birthday of the owner of the club, who was the head of the fire department, too. And so I getting ready to do all of that, and they said, listen, besides Mayor Lindsay and all the celebrities, Judy Garland is coming.
Oh.
Wow. I went, Meshuggah, and I did the whole thing like Arabian Nights with palm trees. Why, I don't know. Palm trees, and like a Hollywood movie set, and I got gay boys I knew to paint their bodies gold and walk around with little bikinis to serve drinks, and ice sculptures of the Munchkins and Judy and all of unbelievable. I knew I would have a chance to welcome Judy in person and get, you know, be with her, I had hoped. And so we're on the boat, and then it's around, I guess, 8 o'clock, and everybody's on the boat already, a mob of 500 people, and then the limos pull up, and it's Judy, Judy's coming. And so everyone runs over to the side of the boat, and the captain was hysterical. He's going to tip the boat, and so they did that. And then Judy came on board. I welcomed her, introduced her. She sang Over the Rainbow and other songs, too, and I got to take her. She was stoned and drunk, as was I, and I got to take her to my little cabin that I had for myself there, and we spoke. We had time, and she gave me some very intimate words of advice. And
such as?
I was telling her a bit about myself and all of that, and she was telling me about Hatzorus, and she said to me, what only counts is never mind your family, she says. You make your own family. Make your own family that loves you or you love. Forget what you had in the past. And that really hit me, you know. And I did. Over the years, I have a big extended family. I've been living a lot of places around the world, Bangkok and Tokyo and Paris and so forth, and I've made friends everywhere, and I keep in touch, and these are family as opposed to what I had, except for my kid's sister, who's my family. So that's how the importance of Judy was. When we had the funeral was for her, I went into the city. There were, I think, 30 or 40 or 50,000 people on Madison Avenue by the funeral home. I couldn't get close enough to get in there to see her coffin. I didn't really want to see that either, you know.
Well, but let me ask the advice about the family, because family is, like it or not, important, whether it's your biological or the family that you surround with yourself that will support you and tolerate you, and in my case, barely tolerate me. But that's understandable. But have you ever, quote-unquote, settled down? Have you had a long-term relationship? Are you in a long... What? Oh,
after
yes.
After Woodstock and my dad died, I moved back to the village, and I was going to gay bars and what opened a phenomenal open called the Meat Market. No, one of I forget her name. In the Meat Markets, which is now very chic with Donna Karan and Calvin Klein. It was the Meat Market District on South 14th Street, and there was a three-story old meat market that was converted to a gay sex club. And I didn't even know what a sex club was. A friend called me and said, there's a sex club. I said, what's that? And we went down, and there were three floors of pitch black, except for maybe a 5.5-watt bulb on each floor, and alcoves and rooms and slings and police cells and all kind of fantasy rooms, even a Central Park room, and people having anonymous sex. It was so dark. You were welcomed by everyone. You didn't feel fat and ugly. You didn't feel short or anything else. You just...
I would always feel short no matter what, no matter where. Maybe you, but no, I would always feel short. Anywho. Don't ask.
Okay. Well, I'm 4'1", so I have a height problem, too.
You are not 4'1". You are not. Sorry?
6'1".
6'1". Oh, that's... What's your height problem?
I always wanted to be taller. I wanted to be like Rock Hudson. And I even met Rock Hudson. As I was a decorator, I met so many celebrities living in the village, and Truman Capote, Marlon Brando, and Rock Hudson. I was at the party where he was on a famous Channel 7 newscaster. I forget the name. It was his penthouse, and there was a big party with a couple of hundred guys there. And there was Rock Hudson. I couldn't believe when I came in, laying on the floor naked and everybody in line. So I got in line, too. I didn't even know how to do anything, and I got in line, too. And
to what?
I don't know. The book just says we messed around. We partied, and that's all I'm allowed to say.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay. Let me ask you, before we get back to the thing, and we just have a couple of more minutes here with Elliot Tiber, but you were about to mention your relationship with Andre Arnott, the director, I assume.
Yeah. I met, coming out of the sex club was this guy, and I was all in leather, was in leather, too, and we went for coffee, and 3 in the morning, and spoke until sun up. And we spent 3 weeks together. He was a theater director from Belgium, here on a grant, a Harkness grant. And he was going back to Belgium, and I panicked, and I sold my apartment, and I moved to Belgium, and we became lovers. We were together 27 years, so I had somebody in my life. He died in 99, unfortunately, young. He was only 54. He was 9 years younger than me. He died from hepatitis. He got from some salad, the doctor said, or something. And so I have my Yorkie. So that's my little love of my life. And I've had friends, but nothing like Andre. I had 27 years of a mensch. He was half Jewish, half Catholic. The Jewish part was a mensch. And
so he felt guilty about being Catholic. That makes sense. But let me ask you, do you think that having that long-term relationship saved your life from AIDS?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. When I met him, I had no self-esteem. No, I had a little bit of self-esteem from Woodstock, just started to sink in a year later that I was able to do what I did. My mother was ashamed of Woodstock till the day she died. She called it filth and dirt and schmutz, even though it made her enough money to live on. And until she was 97. And matter of fact, in the Hebrew home, I said to her, listen, I've been coming here every week. I bring you a bathrobe or flowers, whatever, all of these years, and you never once acknowledged anything to me. You never once said you loved me. Never once, Mama. Silence. And I said, and you never once said anything about Andre. All she ever said, how is your friend? And I said, you don't know his name? She said, well, it's hard. It's hard. It's French. I said, you're Russian. You have French names in Russia. I got so angry. I said, I'll tell you what, Mama, I'm not coming back anymore, ever. You're an old lady. You're not going to be here long. She said, I'm here too long already. I said, I'm not disagreeing, but I'm not coming back unless you can tell me about Andre and that you love me. And 6 weeks, I didn't hear from her. Then I get a call from my older sister who said, Mama's obsessed. She doesn't know why you're not coming to see her anymore. And now I have to go see her, and you should be going and all of that. So I said, she has to call me. So she called, and she said, this is Mama. And she hung up. So I took that, okay. And I went to see her, and I'm waiting to hear something from her about all of this. Nothing. All she managed to say is, don't tell people. I wrote my first Woodstock book then, which didn't sell. But her neighbors read her parts of it. Don't tell people I'm your mother. She has the name Kaisberg, because I'm ashamed of all of that. It's such schmutz. I said, goodbye and so long. And then the next time I was at a funeral, when the son, as you know, the daughters don't count, have to say something nice about Mama. And I told the rabbi, I'm not paying your bill. I don't want any rabbi here. Just open the coffin. I want to make sure the bitch is dead. That shocked everyone in the family. I didn't care. I opened the coffin and she was. And then at the cemetery, they're all waiting for me to say something. Not my sisters, me. I said, they said, say something good about Mama, the rabbi saying. I said, Mama died good. I got in the
window. Wow. Oy, your fault.
See, I know how to get closure. That was closure for me. That was the only closure I could get, you know.
And did the rest of your family, shocked as they were, understand at that point?
No. I stopped talking to them all, and over the years, especially after the fame of the movie came out, and I had, as I say, 7 million blogs, I got letters from people in the family I haven't spoken to in years, and none of them said, I bought your book, it's so wonderful. They were saying, could I get an autographed book? I should give them a book yet. Anyway, as if I didn't have to pay for them. Even if I did have to pay, I mean, I've given my sister books and the close friends books because I wanted to, not because they're family. So, but it's the thing of Woodstock that became such an icon and a resonator around the world has given me such self-esteem that I never knew before, such self-confidence about my looks. I'm fairly okay looking. I'm never a handsome guy, but I mean, I look like Brad Pitt, if you know.
Oh, well, Brady,
yeah. I can tell you that. And without the shirt, I look like him. And so it just gave me self-confidence and self-awareness, and I started doing all kind of work with orphan groups, especially orphans, because they had no homes. That really resonated with me over the years, and raising money for the undertrodden where I could. I'm no great philanthropist. I'm not a rich man. I do all right, but, you know, I do what I can, and I put something back in the pot. So I'm feeling pretty good, and I have my little Yorkie. This one is named Woodstock. The one before was Shayna Madel, because she was.
Aww.
Well, that was Itzkula Pitzkula. I have had Yorkies all these years because of Woodstock.
Well, it is wonderful to hear how a person such as yourself, in circumstances such as yourself, has turned your life around, become successful and creative, and lived the life that you wanted to live, despite what other people were expecting from you or expecting you to do. And I think that is a lesson for everybody to know, as long as you don't hurt anybody, do what you want to do in this world. You want to sleep with men, this is fine. You want to sleep with women, this is fine too. You want to sleep with goats, go ahead. You want to sleep with babies, be careful because their heads aren't fully formed yet. Don't hurt anybody. And that's what it's all about, and try and do what you love in the world. Elliot Tiber, please tell us how we can get copies of your books, to pay for them, to buy them, so you get a little money. Palm Trees on the Hudson, and Taking Woodstock. Do you have a website? I know Square One Publishers has a website, but how can people follow you?
I have a website, ElliotTiber.com. There's TakingWoodstock.com, and there's a new one, PalmTreesOnTheHudson.com. The books are on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble's, Towers, all the bookstores in the country, they have it. It's in 13 languages, and not in Hebrew. I don't know why they didn't want it in Israel, but the book is in Israel in other languages. The book is, the new one is a number one on Amazon. When you go Judy Garland books, it's a number one Judy Garland book, and I'm so pleased with that. It's just amazing to me.
Well,
I'm waiting to hear from Liza Minnelli now. I just sent her a book asking for her comments.
I hope you do hear from her, and I hope you have many more happy years of doing exactly what you want to do, the way you want to do it. And so,
very generous of you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun on your show. I love your show, by the way. I watched it this morning. It's just wonderful.
Well, my goodness, thank you. Oh, if you're saying nice things about the rabbi, huh, then you're my best friend for life.
No, it's a wonderful show. You got a new listener. I'm going to follow it every week. I didn't know about it until my publisher sent me the link, and I looked it up, and it's wonderful.
Well,
terrific show.
As Judy Garland would say, or as she's about to sing, zing went the strings of mine heart. Thank you, Elliot.